Hello and welcome to the Vinyl Countdown, the podcast where I, Jeremy Levine, break down my favorite vinyl releases from cover to cover and everything in between. On this week's episode, the third week of my annual October Spooktacular, October Spooktacular 3D, Beyond the Gates of Hell. I had the pleasure of speaking with Ian Olson from Tapped House. We actually met via the Wizard and the Bruiser podcast page on Facebook. And, you know, we got talking about movies and everything, and then he wanted to come on the show and discuss this week's title, which is the original 1984 Nightmare on Elm Street. It was a lot of fun. You know, we really got deep into it. A lot of tangents, but very interesting tangents that also relate back to the movie and the culture and the impact the movie had on a wide range of things, which we get into. I did want to really quickly here get into Variant Corner to just very briefly discuss that, and then we'll get into the interview, and then I'll come back at the end to finish it off. So let's get on down to Variant Corner. So first up, there were, it appears to be, two releases in 1984. Then a 1989 release was released in Europe. 84 was the US and in Japan. They have two for sale. It looks like it's about $125 for an original pressing, or at least that's what it was last time it sold. But then there is the Japanese version that also sold for about $120 back in June. The 1989 European pressing sold for $68 just last month, so that's really not too bad. Then moving on, it was a full 22 years later before Mondo, I believe, Death Waltz, which you know is also associated with Mondo Tees and all that, they released a run of updated scores and you know a lot of cool colors. There's a red and green split, which obviously you know for Freddy's sweater, right? That is the one I got for two reasons. One, it's because it's the one that I found. They happen to have one at FYE in Lafayette, which anybody from here knows, you know, Lafayette's about 45 minutes from where I am. And I saw it on the shelf, so I was like, oh shit, let me get it. And also, I love split color records, which, you know, regular listeners know that. That's one of my jams. So, you know, picked it up for, I think, $30 or something like that. And now it's selling here for like $58 was the last time it sold back in February. There's a couple for like $73 and up, so not too bad, I guess. There is a Freddy's sweaters stripe, which is like a green stripe down the middle with two like red. I guess it's like it's red, green, and red. So that looks pretty cool. Even though the color of the green, it might be a little too light for the sweater color, I guess, but either way, it looks pretty cool. That one sold for $82, and there's one for sale for $75. So again, not too bad. There's a red with green splatter, which sold for $90 back in July. And then there are four for sale, which one's starting at $92, and it goes up from there. I will say this one's slightly disappointing. It's just because the splatter is like not... It's a red-green splatter, it says, but it's more like a red splatter, and then the green kind of gets lost in the red, so it almost just looks like black, and it's not a lot of splattering anyway, so I feel like that one probably could have been done better. There's just a standard black pressing. There's some for sale starting at $30. For some reason, one sold for $55 last month. Yes, somebody really wanted it. And then in 2020, there was a reissue on what they're calling the Pizza Face, which is more like, it's like a red, either a really, really light pink, or maybe it just looks like pink next to the red, white, like smash swirl variant. It looks pretty cool. The, you know, one side is really marbled and whatever, and the other side is mostly like pink and white, which is a little bit of red, but overall looks pretty good. And that one sold for like $45 back in June, and there's some for sale starting at $60. So I will say the pressing counts on these are unknown on all of them, which, oh, also, I guess the reason I got the split at FYE, I just looked at the notes for it. It is the FYE exclusive variant, so that makes sense. But yeah, you know, it's a great score. Anybody who has watched the movie obviously has heard the score. I think it's an integral part of the movie. It plays a huge role in, you know, obviously setting up the level of dread and the scares and all these things that the movie does well, but the score complements it perfectly, which it should. If the score is good, the movie's good, you know, if everything works together, it just all clicks, and it makes for like a perfect viewing experience. And there's a reason why this movie is a classic, and the score is definitely one of those reasons. So that being said, I will move on to the interview now. So yeah, hope you guys have fun as we dive into it. This is Jeremy Levine, the Vinyl Countdown Podcast, and I'm sitting here with Ian. We, as the title implies, we're going to be talking about A Nightmare on Elm Street, the 1984 version. Also, we'll probably dive into the remake as well. It, for all its flaws, it had some good things, but also a lot of bad things, and it's we'll get into that. Ian, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing well. How are you? Thanks for having me here.
I'm doing great. I appreciate you wanting to come on, man. It's always fun to have somebody else to, you know, talk about this sort of stuff with me. There's only so many interesting things I can pull out and kind of just, you know, scream into the void about. So it's nice to have somebody to kind of bounce back, you know?
Definitely, definitely. That's my pleasure.
So real quick, I want to ask you, what was your first memory of Freddy in general, or like the series? Like, did you see this one first, or did you kind of get into it later and then go back to the first?
Yeah, so, I mean, it just feels like Jason and Freddy have always been with me, you know? I grew up in a family that really does a lot of horror together. My mom was reading Stephen King while she was in labor with me. Like, I was watching horror movies from a very young age. It's just kind of synonymous with this era, with the MTV generation and growing up with, like, having Freddy Krueger be everywhere, having Jason Voorhees be everywhere, having Michael Myers show up all the time. So I don't remember which one of these movies I saw first. I know that the first and the third movie, Dream Warriors, are the like standouts for me and the ones I've gone back to the most. And it just has such a great legacy, and I love everything that Wes Craven's done, and this is kind of really the you know, pin in his hat, like the feather in the cap of what he accomplished and what led to Scream, which was kind of my first like real foray into realizing that I was a huge horror fan.
Yeah, that I think for me, like, you know, Scream was definitely like a kind of a turning point, like, holy shit, I think I really like horror movies, even though I was kind of scared of it at the time, and I was kind of younger. But when I want to say, like I said, for this particular franchise, part three was kind of the one that stuck with me the most, I guess, as a younger child. And I have an older sister who's 8 years older than me, so she was super into it, and I probably shouldn't have. I was kind of sneaking and watching with her, and like my older brother, and he never really cared about horror movies, so he wasn't super into it. She was like, hey, yeah, come, I'm watching, you know, Friday 13th, or I'm watching fucking Child's Play. That got me for a little while, you know. And the first It, I think I was like six when that came out on TV, and I remember watching that, and just like that freaked me out for a long time. But it scared me, but I also really, really, I loved it. Like I liked, I guess, that feeling, and it was like really neat to kind of watch how they would do all the kills, or like how they do the scares and the music and everything else. And with this movie in particular, I think it was probably years went by before I actually saw the original. And once I did, I was like, man, this one's really, really good. Like, they're all good, but this one just has something about it, you know. It's just,
yeah, it's actually scary compared to some, like, once you get like two is its own thing, and there's a lot of great documentaries out there and a lot of great folks that have talked about like the relation to the queer community in that specific installment. And three is, you know, it's still kind of scary, Freddy, but it's more like fun because you're banding together with these kids and kind of going on an adventure to defeat the bad guy. But this first one, it kind of feels like the most intentionally like slasher horror movie before it gets kind of really campy and full of one-liners.
Yeah, they kept, I read a little tidbit that I think originally he was supposed to be silent, like Freddy wasn't supposed to talk much or at all. And then, you know, as you know, later in the series, he's more just like, he's funny and he's dropping like kind of darkly humorous things. Whereas this one, he's more menacing and just like, it is very, I rewatched it the other day, and it was like, man, it still just kind of instills that ugh, like dread, and like really just kind of, really not a whole lot of jump scares either, which is kind of typical of the time, I guess. You know, there's a lot of like, woo, you know, whatever. Yeah. And it's more just him walking slower than like he might have a little burst of something, but it's just, I don't know. It's done so well, you know, and that's obviously, I guess, why we're talking about it.
Well, yeah, in this one, he's referred to as Fred Krueger by everybody. Even in the opening credits, it's Robert Englund portraying Fred Krueger. He does call himself Freddy a couple of times, but mm-hmm. otherwise, you know, everyone knows him as Fred. We haven't gotten on that, like, we haven't gotten on that casual basis with him yet where he is a jokester. He's a lot more menacing for sure.
It's funny how the added two letters in the name can make all the difference. In like Freddy's kind of like, oh, Freddy. But Fred's like, oh, Fred's fucking creepy. Like, that's completely different feelings there.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of noticing this right now, but I wonder if there's a correlation between that and how Charles Lee Ray, when he's the serial killer, is Charles Lee Ray, but when he becomes the doll, he becomes Chucky. And I wonder if there was any influence taken from A Nightmare on Elm Street on that, or if it's just kind of a coincidence.
I never thought about that. That
I mean, just dawned on me right now.
I mean, it's definitely in the same world of thinking. Like, it definitely makes sense, you know?
Yeah.
So I watched a movie called Deadly Blessing. It was God damn it! It's like this town is like killing people, or whatever, but then bringing them back to life and dead and buried. Oh, with okay. Robert Englund is in that movie. And it was funny, he's like seventh build or something like that. I think it was 1981. And it was kind of cool seeing him outside of being Freddy, because that's like what he's been defined as, right? And he kind of had like a background role, and every so often he kind of step up and say something. And it was just really jarring to see him outside of the makeup and just him just being Robert Englund, you know? Mm-hmm. Which too, I guess he was a, I think I read he was a Shakespearean trained actor. Like, he's a real actor, like a real performer, and then now he's and I think that really helped bringing that to the Freddy character and really fleshing it out more than just like a, you know, just somebody just to look scary could have done, you know.
Right. Well, and you compare him to like the other big slashers like Jason and Michael, he of course the obvious thing is he's the only one who talks. He's also the only one that, you know, played the role every single time up until the remake. And he's also a shorter in stature, and the way he does his scares is a lot different than a lot of the other monsters of that era. And I think only Robert Englund could have done that. I know he was on the V television series or miniseries before that, where he played like kind of the nice alien. And he's had some other roles pop up, but you know, this really defined him, and I don't think he begrudges that at all either. Like, you think of a lot of other actors that don't want to get stuck in like a specific genre or a specific character, or you know, struggled with like only being able to play one role, and I don't feel like Robert Englund ever felt that way. Like, he leaned into it, and he was like, well, if this is what the people want and I am enjoying doing this, why should this ever stop? Like, he's even said he would be down to make another movie. So,
yeah. I mean, I'm sure nobody would be opposed to that.
Yeah. No, I'd love it. I know that Elijah Wood and his company Spectrevision has really been wanting to get the rights for Nightmare on Elm Street. And if they could get him and Robert Englund and kind of tell a new story or do a different take, and that would be absolutely fantastic. That'd be a dream.
I would love to see them get their hands on it.
Yeah, absolutely. That'd be
pretty great. So I guess speaking of remakes and retakes and everything else, just what was your first kind of impression of Jackie Earle Haley as like the new Freddy? Like, was he, did you like him, did you not? Like,
it was too large of shoes to fill. I don't blame him. I blame that script. I blame that yeah. era of horror. I blame Platinum Dunes. there are so many things wrong with that it wasn't going to work for him. Yeah. You know, and I struggled seeing anybody taking on that role and doing it very successfully. Although I do think at some point, for a new generation down the line, it's got to happen. There's got to be somebody that steps up and is able to accomplish it. I just, you know, wrong time, wrong place, wrong script, wrong rest of the cast.
Yeah, it's a very forgettable cast overall. You know, it just kind of, like I said, the script is absolutely terrible, and the actors can only do so much, right? Yeah, exactly. And if you're playing such an iconic character and you're coming after someone who has done it absolutely perfect, it's like, what are you gonna do, man?
Like, yeah. And is it Rooney Mara that was playing the lead role?
Oh shit, yeah.
Nancy Thompson role. Yeah, she said afterwards she didn't even want to be in that movie. Like, she got left the audition and it was like, oh no, I got the role, but I don't want it. And it's just like, why take the role then? Like, why are you doing this?
It's like, just like, you know, you can say no, you can just pass on it.
Yeah, you're gonna get other jobs, like, let somebody else take this. But
I think I actually saw it in theaters by myself, like, when it came out, because I was just really interested. I was like, really curious, like, okay, it can't be all bad, it's a new Freddy, whatever. I actually really liked the Friday the 13th kind of reboot they did. I thought that was really done well, so I was like, man, this might be a new trend, let's see. And then it was just like, yeah, this was really disappointed. Yeah, as a lot of people were, I guess.
Those Platinum Dune movies just kind of went downhill. Like, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was fine. Like, it was good. The more I watch it, the less I like it. But I really liked it at the time. The Friday the 13th reboot was, you know, the opening part of that, how they condensed parts 1, 2, and 3 and kind of sped through that. If they had spent more time on that and let that be the whole story, I think I would have really liked that. Mm-hmm. But it does have some great kills in it, and I think out of the three, it's probably my favorite. And, you know, I really wish that we could get some more Friday the 13th action going on, if Victor Miller and Sean S. Cunningham could ever get their shit together and figure out the rights. I really enjoyed that video game that came out, and I know LeBron James wants to buy those rights, and there's money in more Fridays. I mean, we see fan-made movies all the time, like Don't Hike in the Snow Alone, Never Hike Alone. There's some really good ones. That just quality stuff that's being made. People want Jason back, and, you know, but Freddy versus Jason was, I mean, there was so much hype behind it, and I think that film needs a redo. I think we need to get some people in there that, you know, actually care about those stories and those mythologies to kind of do it. But again, all of those movies just kind of fall into that early aughts to 2010 era where horror was just, I mean, media in general was just not a very pleasant place to be.
No.
And some regrettable things happened in the making and the final product of those things.
Yeah, it really, it kind of sucks that the legacies of all those wonderful franchises kind of died there. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of just been hanging out ever since. Like, it's been over a decade now, and it's like, man, we just need somebody to come in and just do it right, just one time.
Yeah,
you know, like they keep making Halloween movies regardless of whether somebody wants them or not.
You know, I'm not as big on Halloween as I am a lot of the other slashers. I really like parts 1 and 3, which I, 3 is an oddball that it doesn't even have Michael Myers in it. So, but I am really excited for Halloween Kills for some reason. I don't know why. Like, 2018, I almost forgot as soon as I left the theater, but for some reason, this one just, it's got me interested in what's going to happen. So,
I will say I saw the extended trailer when I went to see Candyman, and it looks interesting.
Yeah,
and it looks like it definitely held my attention, and I'm like, man, maybe this is the one.
Yeah, well, and they even had the nods to the masks from Part 3 in there with a couple of the kills in that trailer. But speaking of remakes that were done beautifully and in my opinion, an almost perfect movie was Candyman. I think that was beautiful, scary, relevant. Like, Nia DaCosta's bravery with the camera and those slow zooms and those panning shots of the sky, I absolutely loved it. So
I was more than blown away and impressed. Like, when I guess I didn't know what to expect, and when I assumed it was going to be a reboot or a remake or whatever, and it ended up kind of being more of a sequel to just the first movie.
Yeah.
And even there were some things I'd forgotten that they specifically referenced from the first movie, and as they said, I'm like, man, when did that happen? And then when it clicked and then other things started to come together, I'm like, holy shit.
Like, yeah,
they knocked it out of the park with that. Like, that's one I cannot wait
Yeah, and that franchise can just continue on. Like I came out of the theater, the third act I wish had a little bit more room to breathe. Like another 20 minutes would have been great, but I'm also like, okay, let's save some of it for the next installment. Let's keep doing this. Let's make this a thing. Which I mean, you brought up the point of it, erasing the history and being a sequel to the first one, and then also just being called Candyman like the original. So I kind of think that's what we're gonna get with Scream is the parody of that trend happening with the erasure of the rest of the series being a sequel to the first one and just being renamed that way. So that Scream film that comes out in January, I am very excited for it, and probably have far too high of expectations for it to ever meet, but I'll be there opening night.
That's kind of how I feel about switching gears just a little bit about Ghostbusters Afterlife. It's been pushed back so much, and it looks incredible. And like I've been waiting for a proper Ghostbusters 3 since I was a child. Because spoiler alert, Ghostbusters is my favorite movie of all time. And it's just like my entire life, I've always been me and my brother. Have just that's like the pinnacle of movie making, at least for us. And to get this new story that's still it's a continuation of the that universe, I'm just like, man, I'm so excited for it, and I just don't want it to be bad. Even if it is, I probably still love it, but it's just like, I don't know, that's the one I'm really setting it up for failure.
We do this to our favorites, unfortunately, but we'll find something good out of it, I'm sure. I'm sure.
I'll take away something that's like, well, I mean, it wasn't great, but there was this one part, oh boy.
Exactly. So, should we dive into this 1984 classic that kind of brought up everything we're talking about here?
Sure.
All right.
So, like I said, released, it was November 16th, 1984, right before Thanksgiving. That's great time to release a horror movie. It looks like, so I was reading here, the budget was only $1.8 million and end up worldwide gross is like $25 million. So it's like it did really well. I guess it wasn't expected to do a whole lot. And sort of I guess the house that Freddy built is what New Line has dubbed themselves comically over the years, and I guess it's true, right?
Yeah, they were only a distribution company up until this point. Wes Craven had been shopping the script around for quite a while, but people were like, well, it's all in dreams. Nobody's going to be afraid of stuff if they know it's a dream. And, he got in touch with Bob Shea at New Line. They kind of bet their entire company on it, which means Wes kind of bet all of his rights and all of his energy on it. And it ended up being a massive success. And yeah, that $1.8 million turning into what it made at the box office is just impressive, and was able to create nine sequels,
And not only that, it gave us our first look at Johnny Depp. So,
Yeah.
where would we be without the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, without Johnny Depp leading us off, right?
Yeah, what would Tim Burton be doing right now?
Oh man, he would be in a gutter somewhere.
I mean, it's just incredible, and he's playing a jock in this. He's playing across from Heather Langenkamp's Nancy Thompson. He's playing Glenn, and he's supposed to be the preppy boy. And in the script, he was even just like supposed to be even more of a jockey kind of guy. And he looks kind of wide-eyed, and just doing what he's told to get through this first gig. He is definitely not the persona that he grew into later on.
No, not even close. And I mean, he was what, maybe 19, 20 or so, maybe a hair older. Like he was, and you can tell too, he looks very young. Which this movie in general, it seems like the cast were actually really close to the ages of the characters, as opposed to like Scream, for example, where everybody's like 28, 29. I think Skeet Ulrich is like 31, playing a senior in high school. So it's like that whole kind of 90, late 90s to early 2000s trope of like high school movies with like super looking, like adult looking people was not really, they didn't really happen, at least not in this movie.
Yeah, well, I think even compared to like Friday the 13th or Halloween, like this, you actually like Tina's supposed to be 15, they say in the news report on her death, but
That's right.
so it like these kids actually feel young. They feel like kids. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that the parents are so present.
Yeah.
And compared to other horror movies, like, you could almost say that the parents are the real monster in this, and we can get into that a little bit more, but the relationship between the kids and the parents kind of does a lot to bring the youth for these young actors.
And to, if you saw it as a younger person, it helps you to identify with them and be that much more afraid, I guess, because it's like, well, their parents are ever present throughout the movie and they still can't help them or save them or anything else. And it's like, well, hey, my parents are here and they can't help me either, I guess. Fuck, I guess Freddy's gonna slice me up in my dreams, or, you know.
Yeah, yeah, everybody dreams, you can't run from the dreams, your parents can't help you there, so.
Yeah, it's, like I said, especially as a young child, it definitely stuck with me and freaked me out for a long time, but.
Well, one thing, just like a quick side note, I was rewatching the movie again last night, and something that stood out to me about the age, Heather Langenkamp is 21 when they're filming this movie, but they do include nudity of her, and she's supposed to be a 15-year-old character, and I just don't know how I feel about that. So, just quick side note there. That bathtub scene, a little weird.
Yeah, I guess I never really thought about that. I look at her as the actress, and I'm like, okay, she's whatever happened. But it's like, oh shit, she is supposed to be a minor.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the 80s and 90s were very much, that was the thing. It's just like a product of its time, I guess, in that regard.
Absolutely, absolutely. Just something that stood out to me in my most recent rewatch was like, huh, well, that's a choice. Yeah.
Could have done with that. That's cool, Wes. Honestly, I'm trying to think. So when's the first time we see Freddy? Isn't it? It's pretty early on, right? Like he pops up fairly like in the opening credits, right?
Yeah. So the opening scene is him making the glove. You kind of get this smaller box while the credits are running under it. You get the original New Line logo, which is not the New Line logo we would come to see repeatedly on, you know, all the Ninja Turtles movies and stuff like that. But he's making his glove, he's taking apart steak knives, he's finding pieces of metal and grinding everything down. So we start off seeing the monster being made, and he gets his glove all set up, and then we start off, and this is a trope that actually kind of falls into Scream, I think, is we start off with Tina, who we're kind of, not for long, but for a very short period of time, led to believe is our lead. The pretty blonde, she's having bad dreams, she's being chased by Freddy. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that really starts stuff out for us. Again, yeah, right off the bat, we're seeing Freddy in her dream, we're seeing kind of this this dream world that's being created. We're getting, right off the bat, we get Bernstein's soundtrack with that synth line that kind of defines horror movies and kind of the time, and has been a big part of our like 80s revival as far as the synth sound in horror movies. I know I listen to a lot of synth stuff, and it's probably because growing up with these movies. And we also get the nursery rhyme, the 1-2 Freddy's coming for you, with the girls playing jump rope. So we get how integrated this music is into creating this dream logic with Freddy and Tina, all kind of like right to start things off.
Yeah, I think it's kind of fun the way they do that, where, like you said, they right up front, they kind of show you what you're getting into, I guess. Mm-hmm. In a way, they kind of lay it all out there, and then of course get more creative and it gets much more gruesome as the movie goes on. But it is a really nice setup to kind of get you thinking, like, man, what the fuck is like, what is about to happen?
Yeah, what is this like grimy place, and who is this person putting steak knives on their glove, and how is that glove even hanging on his hand with all of the finger pieces missing?
There's a lot of things you got to wonder about, right? But yeah. Now I know you mentioned earlier about the parents being potentially being the true monsters, right? And this is actually something that I've thought about for a long time, that I think, as we know, I guess, spoiler alert for a 37-year-old movie, you know, he is a child killer, right? That's been established. Yeah. And I know that in the original script, he was also supposed to be a molester, which is, you know, they actually did include that very explicitly in the remake.
Yep.
And I honestly was never a big fan of that, I guess. I kind of liked when he was just a child killer, but then taking a step further, you know, the whole thing with the technicality and he got off and then they go in like angry mob and kill him. It would have actually been really interesting if he had been innocent. And then that's why he's coming back to haunt everyone to say, well, hey, you fucked up. So now I'm going to, you know, get in my revenge. So it's almost like a sympathetic thing in a way, right? But when you throw the whole molester angle and it's like he's legit guilty of this, like, okay, well, fuck. You can't feel good for him at all. But it would have been kind of interesting because, like you said, the parents in that particular scenario then are just fucking horrible people. Yeah. And they made a mistake and tried to cover it up. And now it's like, oh, shit, Nancy, that's right. We murdered a dude that we, the creepy janitor, we could have swore he did it. And now he's coming back to haunt you. Sorry. Ooh.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think there is, like, some interesting ways that that could be told, and I think it's interesting that there is this distinction between it's better that he's a child murderer than a child molester, and I understand that, and I feel that, too. but it is interesting that comes up, I think Stephen King has been quoted talking about the end of It. Like, you guys are more worried about that specific scene in the sewer than you are about this child-killing clown. And, you know, there's a lot to unpack there. That probably for the author more so than the rest of us. But
yeah.
But yeah, he was a child killer in the original script. He was a child molester. Satanic panic was going on. There was a the case about the children being flushed down toilets and being taken down to all sorts of weird stuff. The 80s were a strange time, but
I'm pretty sure there was a giraffe slaughtering or something. There's all kinds of shit that was tied to like this weird satanic stuff, and it's like pretty sure it didn't happen, but all right.
Yeah, and these kids were like coerced by the police and their parents to give testimony in kind of a false manner that it was enough in the media that they decided to change it to just being a child killer. And then in Freddy's Nightmares, the anthology series on MTV, a little bit later, we kind of get that prequel in the first episode that's directed by Tobe Hooper of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where we get to see the court case where the cop forgot to sign something. And that's how he got off on the technicality, and then the cop's the first one to throw a Molotov cocktail into his house, and they burn him. Do they call him a janitor in the first movie? Do they mention that, or is that just a remake thing?
That is a good question. I don't know if I ever... I just assume they did.
Because I know in Scream, Wes Craven plays a janitor named Fred wearing a red and green sweater at the high school in Woodsboro. But I don't remember where Fred Krueger being a school janitor originates from. I just wasn't sure if I had missed that somewhere or not. So,
huh. So just a quick Google search. I'm just going to take this with a grain of salt. But it said that in his former life, he worked at a power plant in Springfield, Ohio, as a janitor.
Okay.
And I guess he would use the plant's boiler room as a location where he would kill the children of Elm Street. That is what NightmareFactory.com says, but...
I'm willing to trust that. They probably get into that in one of the sequels, and I just don't remember.
Yeah, I honestly don't remember, I guess, them ever specifically saying anything about it.
Yeah.
But, well, sure, that's it. That is canon. We'll take it from there.
I believe it.
I guess that's does that feel like a thing with the? I guess with most horror movies, like some, I guess lower level. If it's horrible to even say that, I guess, but like janitors, like people, there's a certain stigma around janitors or like whatever other things people view as like these other whatever types of jobs. And it's like those people they look at like, oh man, I bet he's probably a murderer. Like that seems like a thing I grew up with that was like really fucked up.
Yeah, it's this kind of like classism that is expressed through media that way. And, you know, you get like, there's probably even just like a list of like dollar store or like, you know, those movie bin pickups that you could get of bad DVDs where they're just a bunch of killers based on working roles. I'm sure there's, I know there's Ice Cream Man. That's a more popular one that's based off a worker, and I'm sure there's got to be, there's the, in Silent Night, Deadly Night 3, I want to say, there's the line for Garbage Day. He's not actually a garbage man, but they definitely, like, play on the garbage man role before he just shoots his neighbor.
That's, one of the ones I find really, not necessarily funny, but definitely more realistic is in Maniac Cop, the maniac killer is a cop. It's like, I can see that.
I mean, we see that far too often, unfortunately. That's just, seems to be a reality of cop mentality.
Yeah, that's also, that's actually going to be an episode I'm doing later this month, so it should be pretty fun. But that is, that's a batshit movie, but it's so good. But anyway, so back on track here. So, all right, so we're past the intro, right? And let's kind of keep walking through, I guess, the the movie as we goes along.
So Tina gets to, or wakes up from her dream. Her mom, we find out her mom's kind of sleeping around with folks. She's going to be out of town, and Tina doesn't want to be alone. She's been fighting with her boyfriend Rod, so she's not having him come over. So her friend Nancy and her boyfriend Glenn are going to come over, and there's, you know, they kind of all have this thing where they all had bad dreams, but everyone's kind of gaslighting Tina and telling her, hey, don't worry about it so much. Everyone has bad dreams. And if they had just kind of talked, like, right there at the beginning and realized that they all had the same dream, I don't know that anything different happens, but at least they could have all been on the same page a little bit more instead of just ignoring what was happening.
Yeah.
And then, so they're over at Tina's house, and Glenn, has to do some white lies to his parents to stay there, and says he's over at his cousin's, fires up the boombox sounds so that there can be airport noises going over, but then all of a sudden there's drag racing noises, and a shootout starts, and, the girls are laughing in the background, but, you know, it's 80s. Teen comedy, so it works. His parents don't get on his case too much.
I will say, I'd actually forgotten that scene happened, and when I rewatched it, I was like dying laughing. It's so fucking funny. That's one thing. They play it so well, and like they, like the comedic timing of it all, it's really fucking good.
Like, how much of this movie just became Home Alone? Like, which we'll get into more later as we talk about how Nancy actually overcomes Freddy in the third act. But yeah, so much of this movie just evolved into what we know as Home Alone. So they're all getting themselves spooked up, and there's a noise out in the yard. So Glenn goes to investigate, and he gets tackled by Tina's boyfriend, Rod. Rod is, he's the typical bad boy of the 80s film, and he shows up, and Tina and him go upstairs to her mom's room and start very loudly shacking up. I forgot how loud they were. It's like unnecessarily, it's like they put the boombox right next to Glenn's head while he's trying to fall asleep, essentially, and just started making the noises. We get a really cool shot of, it's some awesome practical effects here with, that they redid with CG and the remake where Freddy presses through the wall, which they just did with a sheet over Nancy, as she's starting to have the nightmare. And then we get Tina's, full-on nightmare in the first death of the movie, which is, some more amazing practical effects as they turned the entire room upside down so it could look like she was floating to the ceiling.
That shot, I mean, I remember, of course, as a kid, I was just, like, blown away. Like, holy shit, how they do that? And then as I got older, I kind of read things, and it's like, god damn, like, that's a lot of things going on at once. And to say, like, I guess an older movie, and, like, just to figure things out like that, that's pretty fucking cool. And, again, done extremely well.
Yeah, and it, filmmaker, these practical effects are just amazing. I think I probably underestimated how cool it was, like, when I first saw it, and then when I saw the making of, was like, oh wow, that is what they actually did is kind of more impressive than what you see in the film, just because of, you know, how much it would take to set all of that up and what the actors were willing to do and put their bodies on the line and the risk factor and everything involved, and just the creativity that went into creating some of these scenes is absolutely amazing. So Tina gets slashed up, Rod is in the room, Glenn and Nancy are trying to get in, but the door's locked from the inside, and when they finally get in, Rod has gone through the window, and Tina is there covered in blood on the side of her mom's bed.
It's that scene right before they come in and Rod's gone. It always makes me laugh when Rod's like, "Who's there? I'll kill you." And it's like, dude, nobody, come on.
Like, Rod this whole time, like, it's just like, I couldn't see them, but somebody was there. But the way he tries to express it is just absurd. It doesn't feel like he's pointing out the supernaturalness of it at all.
No, like, yeah, it's like she wasn't floating on the ceiling, you know.
Yeah, doesn't even point out the fact that she was dragged up the ceiling or anything like that. It was just like, well, there must have been somebody else there. I just couldn't see him. It was like, come on, y'all had weird dreams. Y'all shared the same bad dreams, and then you saw your girlfriend flying across the ceiling, getting cut up, like. Maybe it's time to bust out the irrationality a little bit. You know, just get out of your comfort zone and describe this in terms that actually happened.
I do like when they get to the. It was kind of a nice surprise again with the rewatch when they get to the police station scene, and it's the I guess who the police chief was in Scream, who is just kind of like the regular old guy. I guess he's not the booking guy, but he's like, he's there kind of talking to Tina's dad, and it's like, oh, hey, that guy when he was young. That's cool.
Yeah, although I guess
at the time it wasn't that much. It was only like a 10 or 11 year gap between this and Scream at the time, right? Or
12 year gap. 96 to 86, yeah. Yeah, I mean, but still, it's nice. Like, you see that with a lot of these horror directors, and I mean directors in general, where they just work with the same person over and over again, or like they have their people that they call on. David Lynch especially does this. If you watch the Dune movie that he wants nothing to do with in Twin Peaks, like the cast is essentially interchangeable. And I really appreciate it when teams like that come together and you just kind of trust the group you work with and you all get along and continue working together. John Carpenter with Kurt Russell and, you know, Johnny Depp and Tim Burton, you know, these kind of team up things that just kind of happen in Hollywood.
But then, so we're there, you know, and it, again, going back to kind of the classism aspect of things where it's like, oh, you know, Rod, kind of the kid, kind of the bad kid, right on the side of the tracks, et cetera, et cetera. They really are already pinning it on him, like, well, it had to be him because who else would it be?
Right.
You know, it's like, God damn, like, that kind of hurts. That kind of hits a little hard, right? Because it's like, you know, yeah, it looks bad for him, but it's like, you know, he could tell you what happened, I guess, if you actually explain it to you.
Well, and you have your only Latinx actor in the entire movie playing that character, even though he was going under an Italian pseudonym at the time and presenting himself as Italian because that's the way Hollywood was, unfortunately. Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, there's all sorts of layers of context that could be looked at there and how that's set up, where it's racism, classism, in a meta level and in a filmic level. And, you know, he was really struggling with a drug addiction himself at the time. Like, when he's crying in those scenes, when he's in the jail cell, he's actually crying because he is going through a withdrawal or like he just knows that his life is in a bad place. Thankfully in documentaries like Never Sleep Again and other places he's talked, he seems to be doing a lot better. Yeah. But you know, that you don't know that kind of stuff when you're just watching these movies as a kid, but there was a lot happening there. We do meet Nancy's dad here, John Saxon, who all-star of everything really, but he did a lot of Italian horror. He was in Black Christmas. He's played a lot of cops. He's kind of perfect for this role, and it's nice to see him here, and nice to see him reprise this role in part three when he gets to come back too. But he is a jerk cop dad. He's pretty absent. He uses Nancy to capture Rod. Just straight up uses her as bait.
Yeah.
and kind of denies anything that happened as far as what their parents did to Fred Krueger.
It's all that's so messed up. It's like, hey, my 15-year-old daughter, this guy, we think, sliced your friend up. Come and help us out. Or, like, we're not going to tell you to help us out.
We're just going to follow you on your way to school because he's going to come looking for you, and we assume that. So, Yeah, but, and, you know, they claim that because Nancy said Rod and Tina were fighting, that's enough to arrest him and blame him for the murder. It doesn't seem like there's... These families are not about trials or innocent until proven guilty at all. Like,
no.
No. As they've already expressed and demonstrated in the killing of Fred Krueger. So,
let's see. So, after the... I'm trying to think. I'm drawing a blank on the movie, honestly. I watched it like a week ago, and I'm just kind of all scattered all over the place right now.
So after the police scene, I believe Nancy goes back to the house. She's kind of trying to stay awake. She does, I think there's, and then she goes back to school the next day. She's on her way, or yeah. Yeah, no, that's what it is. Okay, she's at school the next day. She hasn't slept at all yet. Her mom didn't want her to go to school, and she is in her English class that's being taught by Lin Shaye, who will later pop up in the Insidious series, and she's great. Yeah. And so she is talking about Shakespeare and Caesar, and then she has one of Nancy's classmates start reading something out of a book. And he's kind of monotone, so Nancy falls asleep, and Nancy is summoned by her friend Tina, who is a bloody girl in a body bag, which the actor who played Tina has said that this was a very scary scene for her to film, because she was zipped up in the body bag, there was no zipper on the inside, so she was in there at the will of the crew and the staff. Of course they took good care of her, but that could feel very claustrophobic. Nancy's body, or Tina's body, gets dragged down the hallway. There's a blood streak on the ground. Nancy's stopped by the hall monitor, tells her no running, and she's wearing the red and green sweater, and when Nancy turns around, she's got the glove on. Mm-hmm. And so we get some pretty good scares here in this dream sequence. And then Nancy burns herself in the boiler room when she has nowhere to go and Freddy's about to get her. She wakes up in her class, screams, freaks out. Lin Shaye comes to her aid and she says, "I'm fine," and leaves the classroom and, just starts walking home and, notices the burn on her arm has followed her back from her dream. Then, this is where we get the bait scene where she noticed before when she was on her way to school that she was kind of being followed, by one of the police officers that suspiciously looks like the FBI or Men in Black or something for some reason in this small town. And, she gets grabbed by Rod and pulled into the bushes, and, he's trying to tell her what happened. And failing to do so, Rod is not the best communicator, and that's when Daddy Saxon shows up and arrests Rod and sends Nancy back home. And a lot happened there. This is probably the most iconic dream sequence from the first movie, with the hall monitor and Tina and the body bag. There's a ton of stuff going on there, and we get some of the soundtrack hits here are really good. The boiler room scares and stuff. We go from kind of this really calm synth sound that Bernstein's been using this whole time to some really intense drum and more industrial sounds. We get more scrapes of the claws on the pipes, which are painful to hear. That is not pleasant at all. And so those dream worlds get most of our like actual music stuff. In the real world, there's, or what we're supposed to believe is the real world, the waking world, there is a lack of music at times. And that's something I actually didn't mention with Tina's death, is that while we're seeing it from Tina's perspective in the dream world, we're getting the all the synth music, everything speeding up and whatnot. But as soon as we cut to Rod, it's silent. And I think that silence on the soundtrack, on the score, is actually, you know, really impactful, and makes that death even more gruesome.
Obviously, I guess I never thought about that in terms of using the score to, you know, because like I said, we're supposed to believe this is the waking world, this is no longer the dream world, and that's when the kind of the more intense music goes away, and you kind of draw, you very quickly realize, okay, now we're no longer dreaming, like, I guess we shouldn't be scared anymore type of thing, right? And it's like, I guess I never really noticed how clear that cut of the, you know, the two worlds are, right?
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. We do get the nursery rhyme a few times in the waking world. The first time it shows up is in the waking world, the second time in the dream world, and then the third time when Nancy's saying it to herself in the bathtub. But yeah, there's a pretty good distinction between how intense the music gets, how loud the music gets, how present the music is in the dream world versus the waking world, which I think is a nice touch. And I don't know, you know, how much thought went into that. In interviews with Bernstein, it didn't sound like he was giving a whole lot of thought to those kinds of things when scoring the film, but it worked out that way, and I think it's a nice touch.
Next up, I think the next one to go, right, is Glenn. Oh, no, I'm sorry.
It's Rod, yeah. Cause,
that's right, so, yeah, because he gets killed in the jail cell.
Yeah, so here we have Nancy's trying to stay awake. She does the bathtub scene, the infamous bathtub scene where the claw comes out and between her legs, and, you know, Freddy is doing sexy things. It's like, fine, we don't explicitly say he's a child molester anymore, but he's going to do this, which kind of implies it pretty heavily. She gets pulled under the water. That's when the only nudity in the movie happens, and it's in a dark blue light, but I, you know, it just stood out as a choice. then Nancy's mom breaks into the bathroom. Nancy pulls herself out of the bath, and she finds a version of Nodos in the medicine cabinet that she starts to take. And her mom is drinking and, you know, suppressing something, obviously, and not being all that great to her. And so she goes up into her room, and she's watching some horror movies on TV, trying to stay awake. She keeps dozing off, and then Glenn shows up at her window, saw the light was on, and Nancy devises a plan. She is going to use the dream world to go check on Rod. And so she goes to see Rod in jail, and sees that Freddy Krueger is moving towards Rod. So they make their way to the jail to try and get some action there, to try and get people to go check on Rod and make sure nothing's happening. Of course, they refute the kid's claims, and they take long enough that we find Rod hung from the top of his jail cell with his bed sheet. These effects with the sheet were done by unwrapping it from his neck, so doing everything in reverse. They had a knot set up so that someone at the edge of the bed could slowly pull the sheets, and then they just played that in reverse as to make it look like it was wrapping around his neck without having Freddy there. So that was a pretty interesting way to do that. Rod does go from breathing and struggling to being dead and kind of bluish colored very, very quickly. Yeah. It's like as soon as his feet leave the ground, he dies, which I'm not sure that that's how suffocation works, but...
I guess movies very much taught me wrong on that when... Yeah, as I got older and started looking into, like, you know, like true crime podcasts or things of that nature, you kind of hear details and it's like, oh, so it doesn't take 15 seconds to choke somebody out.
Yeah. I always thought quicksand was going to be way more of a problem than it is, you know?
Yeah.
So that's our second death, our second death here is Rod. And then we kind of get, you know, Nancy and Glenn are struggling to stay awake and are trying to team up together. Their parents are getting even worse. Glenn's parents think Nancy is crazy and won't let them talk anymore. Nancy's mom slaps her, and things really, you know, just start to heat up. And Nancy realizes, all right, well, I'm in this on my own. And she sees, like, she has one bad dream where she has to sees the feather falling from her window from one of her dreams earlier, where Freddy slashed up one of her pillows, and intimidatingly swung the pillow around like he was in a pillow fight. And so she sees the feather falling. She tries to call Glenn's parents, put the phone off the hook, tell her that she's in, or that Glenn's in bed. And they won't be talking that night. And then we cut to Glenn, who falls asleep on his bed with his TV in his lap, as you would do. Yeah. And he gets sucked into his bed for another amazing practical effects kill, where they pulled him through the bed. The room is then turned upside down, and all of the blood that they had left on set was poured through the bed. I don't know that it was all that they had left, but it is a lot of blood. It is probably more blood than it is in is one human.
I think I read it was somewhere around 500 gallons, they estimated.
Wow. Wow.
Which is like, goddamn, like that's way more than one human's worth of blood.
Yeah, there's a lot of blood in us. It's surprising how much of it squirts out of us when we get cut open, but that was a lot. And Glenn's mom comes to find this, and that's gotta be traumatizing. But you know, they don't go across the street or anything like that. They just call the cops. Nancy is locked in her house at this point, barred through the window, and she had earlier devised a plan using a book on how to set up booby traps. That she was gonna, you know, trap Fred Krueger in her house, and she was gonna try and pull him out of the dream. And so this final act is them battling each other and her trying to pull him out of the dream, and eventually doing similar to what happens at the end of It, where, you know, they just kind of say, you don't have this power anymore, I'm taking it away from you, and he turns into a gem in the holograms kind of stage lights and disappears. Mm-hmm. And
that, and like I said earlier, full on Home Alone in this part, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It's just fucking pranks everywhere.
Trip wires and like sheets that are falling down, and you know, we flash between the real world and the dream world, and there's fire all over the house, and you know, there's a boiler room in Nancy's basement now, and but yeah, no, it's a really fun third act. There's not a lot of logic to it. There doesn't need to be. And this was the end that Wes Craven wanted. This was it was supposed to be Nancy defeats Fred Krueger. That's the end of it. That's the end of the story. There were gonna be a positive ending. She was gonna come outside. It was gonna be sunny, and things were gonna be okay. And there wasn't going to be another, you know, five sequels, a remake, and Freddy versus Jason, and it was just supposed to stop there. But Bob Shea, who had put all of his money into this with New Line and bet his entire company on it, wanted a stinger for the possibility of a sequel. Mm-hmm. So we see Nancy go outside. She gets into Glenn's car, who's now back and okay, and Rod and Tina are there, and her mom's on the porch, and then the hood of the car comes up, and it's Freddy Krueger colored, got the red and green going on, and a blow-up doll gets pulled through a window.
Yeah.
That's supposed to be Nancy's mom, but, you know.
Yeah. It's, I mean, honestly, I think if they had just ended it there, right? Like, if Wes Craven had gotten his way, sure, we wouldn't have gotten all the sequels and all the other things, but that would have been a perfect ending, right? Like, that would have been great in its own right.
I kind of go back and forth on this. Like, it would have been great to see Nancy vanquish the evil, and, like, it would have been fine. But I also really like this stinger, because I like endings where the bad guy wins. And so this kind of gives you that a little bit more. It's not like, no, you didn't just get away with everything. And but I do go back and forth on that. Like, I know Wes Craven as a storyteller, if that is the ending we had and that is all that I knew, it would probably feel like the perfect ending. But having the ending we have, I'm pretty happy with as well. Even the dodgy blow-up doll being pulled through a tiny window.
It's kind of a hastily shot, like, hey, we want you to do this last thing for us. All right, and it's like, fuck, okay. And it's kind of pull it together and just, like, shoot this last, like, God damn it. All right, let's get it over with.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it was Wes was not trying as hard on that shoot as other shoots because he didn't want it. So it was just like, whatever, we don't need good effects for this. Just hopefully they'll cut it. Hopefully it won't make it to print kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it did, and it became massive. It kind of revitalized, and I think Wes Craven has done this a number of times, or did this a number of times, was revitalize a horror genre that was kind of languishing in self-repetition.
Yeah.
And, so now we see it happen with Nightmare, and then again with Scream, where horror was... people were kind of burnt out on seeing the same slashers over and over again, and then we get Krueger, who can do anything. We don't have to figure out how to hit someone with an axe again. We don't have to figure out how to stab someone again. We can have our bad guy turn into a giant snake and eat Patricia Arquette.
And there's so much that he's done, like, so many, like, it's hard to keep track of all every single, like, transformation and, like, but yeah, like, it's, the possibilities are literally endless.
Yeah.
With a villain like that. As opposed to Jason, who can, you know, he can chase you around and he can do some shit, but it's like, at the end of the day, he's still essentially just stabbing people.
Yeah, is it going to be fast Jason or slow Jason? Is it going to be, you know, big head Jason or mask Jason? He's going to hit you with a machete or an axe or, you know, slam you against a tree. That's pretty much his thing. And then it comes down to how good the final girl is to really carry that, which I do think Nancy is up there in top final girls for me. I don't know if she's number one. I controversially really like Chris Higgins. I think she fights back against Jason in ways that other people didn't. I mean, there are a ton of greats, but you know, those are the two that really stand out to me as the ones that kind of stood up to the monster the best.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it maybe recency bias a little bit, but Neve Campbell I thought was great.
Oh yeah, I mean,
in Scream and in all of the Scream movies, she's perfect. Everyone that she appears in, right? And it's just like, I guess, you know, with these movies, I was like, I was into horror, but not like, I was like, again, I was a child, and it's like they were just spooky and whatever. But then to really watch them and try to understand them and kind of pick apart things as I got older, I was like. With Scream, that was where I really kind of came into that.
Sure.
So I guess for me, it's one of those things where it's like, man, Neve Campbell, she was a fucking badass. Like,
well, and the great thing about Scream is it gave everyone a springboard to do that. You didn't have to be a horror nerd to know the tropes all of a sudden because you got Randy there telling you what the tropes are. which I'm curious to see how they're going to incorporate him into the new Scream movie. I wonder if we still have another VHS he's pre-recorded his sister can bring by in a van to tell everyone the rules of the rebooted sequel.
I imagine now it's going to be like a TikTok video or something. It's like, he has some funky music behind him. It's like, here's the top 10 things to do. And it's like...
it's like Randy... Yeah, it'd have to be like Randy's nephew just like wearing a Randy face swap or something like that.
That makes it sound god awful.
I mean, that's most of the time I see TikTok, that's how I feel, but I am old, so. I guess, like, as far as the music goes for this, Charles Bernstein, who he got his start in the movie biz in 1968, so quite a bit before this movie came out. He studied at Juilliard and at UCLA. And he was interested in theater. His mom had played a Wurlitzer organ accompanying silent movies at a theater, and he got offered a little documentary about Czechoslovakia And it was an all-music film. There was no dialogue or anything. And it ended up winning an Oscar, and that was the first movie he ever scored.
Oh, wow.
And so he got a lot of cred in Hollywood. He was able to just kind of get jobs from then on. His horror repertoire, he was... The first horror movie he did was The Entity, which is a very disturbing movie about a ghost that sexually assaults a woman. There are some very interesting bladder practical effects in that, where they would, like, put fake skin and use bubbles to... Yeah, it's an interesting but very... very hard movie to watch. So he did the score for that, and then he did the score for Cujo, the mm-hmm. Stephen King story, which I haven't watched that movie in a long time, but I recently reread the book, and I think it's my least favorite Stephen King story.
Really?
It's every character in the story is completely unlikable except for the dog that just is sick that nobody took care of. And I know he says that he, like, doesn't remember writing that because he was on too much coke and, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But, and I believe it because there are scenes in that book that are from Cujo's perspective. And they, yeah, yeah. The cocaine is real. Stephen King was able to put his mind into the mind of a rabid dog.
You know, speaking of cocaine, that's one thing they could have probably done in... to stay awake in this movie, right? Like, because it was the 80s, they're kind of, you know, yeah. well-to-do family. Like, Nancy's mom is definitely doing a bunch of shit. Like, you know, she has some coke laying around that house somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they could have easily just, like, you know, 4 or 5 days just been on a fucking bender and been totally fine.
That's true. It's true. I don't know why Nancy and, I mean, Rod probably had a hookup for it in his neighborhood, so.
Maybe so.
But, well, and, you know, it's white, wealthy suburbs. It's probably popping up everywhere. But I think there was a real focus on, you know, calling out Reaganism and family values of the 80s. And I think that Wes Craven was consciously doing that. He is really pointing out that, like, the sins of the father kind of thing, like, the transgressions of these parents are coming back to reflect on the children. They would rather repress and regress than talk about, you know, the feelings and things that are going on, the trauma that's occurring. It's be better to just, you know, uphold this view of our community as something really good than to actually listen to our children. So that's where the reading is the parents as the real villains kind of comes into play, and, you know, society is the real villain, but... it's less like didactic than in a Romero movie where it's like really in your face where like, oh, yeah. We're the mindless monsters that just consume. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, it's a little more subtle with Wes. Like, it may be, you know, it's there, you got to kind of dig for it, but it's definitely there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say, I did see with Charles Bernstein, there's another movie he did right after this, April Fool's Day, that I actually watched, I think, last summer. And it's really fucking good. Like, it's great. Yeah. And that too, the score is awesome in it. And like, I think going into it, I didn't know what it was. It just was on Prime, I think. And I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot, you know. And like, I ended up just really, really enjoying it.
Yeah, no, that's another classic. I you know, by this time they were starting to run low on what holidays and days they could use for slasher movies. But that one slipped by for a little while, for sure. Yeah, and then there is one track on this soundtrack that's not by Bernstein, and it's the end credits song by a band called 213 that was based out of Los Angeles. They shortly broke up after this movie came out, and due to some rights issues, their stuff never made it into the public. The most recent thing I was able to find was in 2009 they had come to an agreement, but none of their stuff is... I couldn't find it anywhere. It doesn't help that 213 also, you know, became the name of the hip-hop group that Snoop Dogg was in, which makes it really hard to uncover anything in Google. But even in all the digging I did, 213, the band that did the Nightmare song for the end credits, that's really all they're known for.
Wow.
You know, even 4 out of 5 Doctors was able to, like... have an album or two come out after House on Sorority Row. So I figured I'd be able to find something about this end credit band, but nothing. Not even a single other track out there. And it's you know, right in line with the rest of this, is very quintessentially 80s.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's only like a minute and 50 second long song. So if they're out there somewhere, release the rest of your music. We want to hear it. Show up to a convention. Make some money off signatures or something.
No shit. Just think they pop up next year at some point. It's like, hey, we did the ending theme. It's like, holy shit.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's Elijah Wood is just keeping them like, you guys, just wait. Just wait. We're going to get the rights. Then you're going to come back and do the whole soundtrack.
So, scale of 1 to 10. I'm pretty sure I know the answer already, but what is your rating for this particular movie?
Man, actually, that's kind of a tough question. If I'm going to put it in, like, the grand scheme of all the horror that I watch, I think this has to be in like the 7 to 8 range. It's a fantastic movie. It's critical. It's got a huge legacy, but I will say that I've always been more drawn to Child's Play and Friday the 13th when it comes to my slasher films. And I still think I wouldn't put any of them at a perfect 10. I think if you're talking perfect 10s in horror, you're talking The Wicker Man, Hereditary, The Witch, Haunting from 1963, Suspiria, both versions, although I'm actually preferential to the remake in 2018. I think it's what Luca Guadagnino did was absolutely beautiful. And Dakota Johnson and Tilda Swinton just kill it in that film.
Yeah.
But, you know, those are really my like, peak horror for myself. And I know there's the term like elevated horror, prestige horror that goes around, and I get down and dirty with all the slashers and 80s movies as well. One Dark Night's one of my favorites. I just laughed a whole bunch at Malignant. That was great fun. Slacks, that was the Shudder original about a pair of killer jeans that kills everyone in a overnight shift at essentially a Forever 21. If you've ever worked retail, I definitely recommend checking that out. I cracked up the entire time. But I do kind of gravitate more towards the folk horror kind of stuff when it comes to what I consider my absolute favorites.
I think I agree with you there. I mean, this movie, it just from a cultural standpoint, from a nostalgia standpoint, and as it stands, it definitely holds up extremely well 37 years later, right? Like, it's still a really good movie, but filmmaking and things have progressed so much. And just for myself, like you mentioned Hereditary, that's probably my favorite horror movie from the past, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. Like, it's, I preach that movie to anybody who'll listen and try to, like, if you like horror at all, please just do me a personal favor and watch this movie.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, definitely.
You will love it. And it's like, and nobody's listened yet, but you know, I'm still trying.
Yeah, I sit people down and just watch that movie all the time. So
I'm pretty sure I watched it, I want to say, oh man, like 3 times within like a week period.
Yeah,
when I finally got my hands on it, I was blown away. I'm like, holy shit. And second time I started to notice more things, and third time I've noticed so many little things every single time I watch. And like, I've tried not to dive too much into trivia or like whatever, because I kind of want to just keep finding things, I guess. Like, it's because there's so much. Like, he's awesome at that.
Absolutely, absolutely. Oh, and I didn't say earlier when it comes to top line horror, Alien and The Thing are also on that list for me. So, and you want to talk about amazing soundtracks, The Thing with Ennio Morricone and then John Carpenter just putting his little bump over the top of it. That's absolutely beautiful. But you spent a bunch of time talking about John Carpenter over the last couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, that, I'm still kicking myself for not getting The Thing vinyl soundtrack. Like, came out, but I think Waxwork put it out, and it was there for the, like, I could have got it, and I was like, man, I'm gonna hold off for a minute, and then it sold out, and now it's just like, fuck.
Yeah, now it's just too much to track down.
Yeah,
but I mean, Freddie did have a huge legacy as far as music goes. Like, not just Charles Bernstein's soundtrack, which just got reused over and over again. Like, you look at some of the other scores, they got, you know, changed up a little bit. And, you know, people would come back and rewrite them, like Manfredini on the Friday the 13th series, John Carpenter up to a point with Halloween, and then it getting passed off to other people who decided to do new metal versions of the Halloween theme. But Freddy actually popped up on MTV. He had his anthology series, you know, Freddy's Nightmares, which we kind of talked about that first episode, is his origin story. The rest of it is just absurdity. I don't recommend it, but at the same time, if you are as into horror and camp as I am, then definitely seek it out. The third movie, Dream Warriors, was one of the first movies to have a tie-in music video that actually had Robert Englund and Patricia Arquette in the music video heavily, and that was Dawkins' Dream Warriors. It's a, you know, very silly song of the time. And then later down the road, the Fat Boys did Are You Ready, Freddy? Where Fred actually raps with the Fat Boys as they spend a night in Nancy's house that's referred to as Frederick's house for some reason. And there's actually a lot of intrigue around that, because apparently Will Smith wanted to do something with Fred Krueger, but New Line went with the Fat Boys, and then New Line tried to sue Will Smith because one of his songs was too, or, like, mentioned Freddy Krueger or something like that. And
I think it was like a Nightmare on My Street or something like that. And then they went after him and Jazzy Jeff. And supposedly that spun off into, well, it's like, hey, we'll drop it or whatever if you play in this movie for us or whatever, which turned out to be a house party with Kid and Play.
Ah, okay.
So it's like a whole thing there, which they've kind of disputed that. I think I saw an interview with Play, like, from last year maybe, where he was kind of discussing that, and it wasn't quite like that. It's kind of what the urban legends sort of come to now, but it was more like, hey, we're going to see you guys, and we're like, no, we don't want to. I think the director of House Party didn't want to cast them, Will Smith and Jazzy Jeff, under that pretense, and he was like, no, I'm not going to do it. And then I guess they ended up settling for something, and then it was like, well, hey, we'll Kid and Play, we'll do it. Yeah, it was a whole thing. But
wow. I mean, yeah, there's more to that story than I knew then. And then, you know, hip-hop still being a part of Fred Krueger today. Bernstein said in an interview last year with WTOP that a lot of his stuff has been sampled in hip-hop. And last Halloween, he started working on producing some hip-hop. So he's just looking for the right artist. And would like to put out his own hip-hop produced album with his Freddy tracks. So I don't know what that would look like, but
no. I do know a few years ago, 21 Savage, in one of his songs, he does mention, he's like, there's a nightmare on Elm Street, and like it's prevalent. Like, there's definitely, I mean, they all grew up with us around, they're all around the same age as us, I guess, you know, late 20s, mid 30s types, and it's like, that always sort of filters in somewhere.
Yep.
You know, which, I mean, it's kind of cool to see that influence just like really get his fingers out into everything, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, you got George H.W. Bush mentioning Freddy Krueger economics in the 80s, like, and like, it's still rolling strong. These, and you know, when it comes down to it, it's Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees, Chucky to an extent, Candyman. These are our generation's universal monsters. These are Frankensteins, our Draculas, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense that they've permeated all of pop culture. Like, eventually, I wouldn't be surprised if we have more cereal lines or chips or the Super Bowl is sponsored by, you know, having these monsters all over their stuff, because that's what happened to the universal monsters, too.
Yeah, they eventually got watered down to a point where it's just like, they're popping up on kids' cereals and all kinds of things.
Yeah, Wolfman's got nards, dude. Oh, Monster Squad reference there. But yeah, it's really cool how the nightmare lives on, and how, you know, the music has continued to be influential, and how it's popped up in music, and, you know, we have this 80s revival. I think we're moving a little bit more towards 90s now. I think Fear Street is really the beginning of us having some horror movies that are more based in the 90s. Although yeah. they kind of use the entire 90s soundtrack in the first 30 seconds of that movie, so we'll see if there's anything left. I enjoyed it, but wow, the needle drops were just like, okay, I get it, we're in the 90s, but nothing actually looks like the 90s, so...
I'm glad I'm not the only one who was a little thrown off by that. It seemed like it was like every like 2 minutes they were playing a new song. It's like, god damn, like you're like halfway through one song and it's like another song, another song. It's like
from the bus scene to where the little brother sees the cheerleading drug dealer girl that gets her head cut up. They actually play four songs in like 30 seconds, I think it is. It's ridiculous. Wow. They just cut right into each other. And yeah, I thought that was a little jarring. But otherwise, I think that series was very good for what it was supposed to be. I think Lee Janiak did a really good job. But yeah, that's another story for another time.
Yeah. Well, before I let you get out of here, man, is there anything you'd like to plug? Anything coming up for you? This episode should be going up, I think, on the 22nd. So anything around there or anything coming up for you?
So definitely. You can find stuff that I do at Tapped House on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. Tapped House TV on Twitch and YouTube. We have gaming stuff, streams that come out, different podcasts. We have a short horror podcast called Just Another Horror Story that we work on. And actually, the 24th, so 2 days from when this episode gets released, my first short movie will be premiering at the Edmonds Theater in the Seattle area. It's called Sign in Blood, and that will quickly go up on YouTube after we kind of do our friends and family and people involved premiere at the theater. And, you know, just follow us, check us out. We're going to be hitting up the film festivals here. I am a horror nerd, so making horror content is what I want to do. And we've just got a collection of other great people that are creative and creating media, and we're just all working together. Again, that's Tapped House, wherever you can find us.
Awesome, man. I appreciate you coming on. Yeah. And like I said, as for me, as usual, the Vinyl Countdown on Instagram, Facebook, and Vinyl Podcast 5 on Twitter, because I could not get the Vinyl Countdown. But yeah, I'm there. I'm most active on Twitter, I guess, and Instagram. Facebook is just there because it just happened to be there, but it's not the best way to promote. But this whole month, again, this will be just all horror movies all the time, sort of from start to finish. It's my annual spooktacular, and it's always a blast doing it. I love breaking the normal format and coming in and doing this. It's pretty great. And I appreciate having you on as well because, again, it's always fun to have someone else to speak with about it as opposed to me just yelling into the proverbial void and whatnot.
For sure, it's been a blast. I really appreciate you having me, and you've got a great show here, so I'm looking forward to continuing to listen.
All right, I appreciate you, man. All right, I'll talk to you later.
All right, so that was my interview with Ian Olson from Tapped House, and like he said in his plug, check out his first short film. He is releasing it October 24th, and then after the initial theater release, it will get pushed out other places, so follow them on Twitter so that you can be in the know with that. Also, real quick, I don't know what happened. I screwed something up in the editing, but I did cut off the last thing he said to me, which was just saying bye, so it's not like I was just like saying bye and he said nothing back. It was just, I think I fucked something up when I edited, but that's it. So I hope you all had a good time. I had a great time talking with him, and as I mentioned before, I was really appreciative of him coming on. This is a lot of fun. So as for me and the show next week, moving into week number 4 of the Spooktacular, I will be diving into 1980s The Fog, which, spoiler alert, I highly recommend it, right? So come back next week to hear me dive into that. Should be a lot of fun. You know, John Carpenter is a masterful musician and filmmaker, so it's like the best of both worlds, right? So should be a lot of fun. Come back for that. So, for the Vinyl Countdown, I'm Jeremy Levine, and I hope to be in your ears next week, everybody. Thank you. Take care.